Good morning, everybody.
Good morning.
It is December 9th, and we are in Judges chapter 8. Technically, I suppose we're at verse 28, but I'm going to back up just a few verses and get a running start. We're still in the story of Gideon. I told you that it would take an interestingly long amount of time to get through it. And looking at what we have left to do, I think it can fit very nicely in the next two Sundays. That's not a promise. But that would make a nice break point going into the holidays where we wouldn't be in the middle of a single episode. So we'll see if it falls that way. I think there's a good chance that I can finagle that. What it means, not that this hurts my feelings or breaks my heart in any way, but what it means is that I have just a little bit more time to talk about some of the really interesting subtleties that are under the surface of this story, especially in the verses that we just started talking about last week and that we'll talk about today and next week. Some subtleties that are lost in translation out of the Hebrew. Some things that are happening in the story that aren't expressly stated, but when you read it carefully and think through what certain things have to mean, you can begin to see more of the picture than you might just on a first superficial reading. It's really interesting, and I'm looking forward to being able to poke into that just a little bit. But first, this is also going to be interesting for another reason. For the first time in I cannot imagine how long it's been, through a fluke, a single moment that could sort of change your morning, I walked out of the house without my smartphone or without my reading glasses. Now, I keep a set of reading glasses in my cubbyhole here at church, so I'm all set there. But if I forget my smartphone, it means I forgot my Bible. And I haven't used one of these in a long time. I mean, there's a running joke that I often use. I've been meaning to get myself a Bible ever since seminary. But, so I have a paper Bible. So whoever listens to this on the web gets to hear the pages rustling as I turn them. It'll be different. It just makes it hard because I don't have any place to put my notes. All right, so Gideon. By way of a really quick review, we have seen Gideon go from I don't want to say a coward, but very tentative, very unconfident young man that God approached to raise up as a judge to save Israel from the Midianites, who keep swarming in and stealing the harvests, stealing the livestock, grazing the stubble down to nothing, and then leaving again. It's been going on for 7 years. You're bordering on famine circumstances at that point. Gideon is looking for a sign. He gets a sign from the angel of the Lord who comes to talk to him. He gets another sign with the fleece. Actually, that's kind of two signs. One morning, the fleece is covered with dew and the ground is dry. The next morning, the ground is covered with dew and the fleece is dry. And then God actually gives him a fourth sign to boost his confidence that Gideon doesn't even ask for when he sends him down into the Midianite camp the night before the battle, or the night of the battle, and he hears that there's a dream that's being told about and circulating through the Midianite camp. And for reasons that maybe defy explanation, at least at that point in the story, they even know who he is, Gideon, the son of Joash. And the Midianites interpret the dream to mean that they're going to fall to him. So that boosts him tremendously in confidence. He goes back, he gets his little army that has been whittled from 32,000 down to 300 men by God's instruction, so that this battle will clearly be the Lord's. And they surround the Midianite camp, and just as the watch changes, they break the clay pots, they raise up their lit torches, they sound their ram's horns, and the Midianites, probably thinking that there's a whole lot more soldiers behind the trumpeters and the torchbearers, panic, if they weren't already panicked by the dream reports, and they turn on one another. And Gideon's army never even descends to do battle. There's a cute little piece in there where they shout a sword for the Lord and for Gideon, but if you got a torch in one hand and a ram's horn in the other, you don't have a sword. Israel has had trouble having swords all through the book of Judges. But the Midianites have swords, and God uses those. So the Midianites are routed, and they flee. We find out later in chapter 8, a point we've already passed, that there were 135,000 Midianites, and only 15,000 get across the Jordan. So it's a massive victory that has to be credited to God, because 300 men with torches and trumpets could never have done it on their own. And yet, questions of who gets the glory do begin. And once the battle is over, we see Gideon do some things that at first only seem maybe totally innocent, maybe just curious, but it builds until we clearly see that something is wrong. Something has changed in Gideon. First, he calls for reinforcements from the nearby tribes to pursue the fleeing enemy. Maybe nothing wrong with that, but it sure is a different philosophy than what God had used in the battle. He calls on Ephraim, which had not been part of this whole story, to try to cut off the enemy before they can cross back over the Jordan. That causes a conflict because Ephraim's upset that they didn't get to play in the main battle. Of course, Ephraim probably doesn't know that there really wasn't much of a battle in the main battle. But Ephraim is upset that they feel robbed of some of the glory, and that's a foreshadowing of some issues with Ephraim that we're going to see later in the book. Gideon sweet talks them, settles the issue. He continues his pursuit across the Jordan, up the Jabbok Valley, to a couple of towns where his exhausted and hungry 300 men would love to get some food, but the towns of Succoth and Penuel both refuse, because how can a group of 300 men possibly defeat thousands of Midianites, who will then, once they squash Gideon like a bug, be upset with Succoth and Penuel if they help? So Gideon threatens them, says when he comes back in peace, he'll exact revenge on them for not helping. He captures his enemies, a couple of Midianite kings, Zebah and Zalmunna, marches them back to Succoth and Penuel, says, "Ha, see, I told you so." And then he really does punish those cities. "Fellow Israelites, and the war is over, so this isn't collateral damage, this isn't anything that seems justifiable. Unless you see Gideon is involved in a holy war, so to speak, still operating at God's instruction and bringing divine justice against those who try to keep him from doing God's will." And on a superficial reading of the story, that is a way to interpret it. But then he turns to these two kings, and he asks them, "What happened to the men. Let me find it here. 18? Yes, it is. Where are the men whom you killed at Tabor in chapter 8, verse 18? And that is a... That should startle us as readers. Because that's something new in the story. Tabor isn't even part of this story. It's not far from Ophrah, but it's not part of the story as we've read it up to now. And Zebah and Zalmona say, as you are, so were they. Every one of them resembled the son of a king. Remember that phrase, the son of a king. And Gideon said, they were my brothers, the sons of my mother. Okay, so now it's a double shock. Again, this is nothing that we knew when we were first introduced to Gideon. At some point in the past, these two Midianite kings, on one of their other forays into Israel, presumably, killed his brothers. And it's not just figurative, it's the sons of my mother. As the Lord lives, if you had saved them alive, I would not kill you. And then he says to his firstborn son, Jether, rise and kill them. Now it's starting to sound like something of a blood feud in Gideon's mind, and he wants his son to be part of it. This also puts a completely different spin, and I made a brief reference to this last week. This puts a completely different spin on some of the things that we're told when we're first introduced to Gideon. Do you remember what Gideon first says when God, when the angel of the Lord approaches him? That's part of it, yes. If the Lord is with us, then why has all this happened? I'm back in Judges 6, verse 13. And where are all his wonderful deeds that our fathers recounted to us, saying, did you... There sounds like some bitterness there, maybe. At first, it sounded like he was more concerned for his people than for himself, and that may well be true, and that would be to his credit. But now when you know that the Midianites killed his family... It's also possible to read a statement like that and think there might be a little bit of bitterness in it. That is speculative on my part, and I want to make that clear. But it makes me start to wonder. And then he says in verse 15, please, Lord, how can I save Israel? Behold, my clan is the weakest in Manasseh, and I am the least in my father's house. I read that differently now that I know that all his brothers were killed. We didn't used to be the weakest in Manasseh, but we are now because all my brothers were killed. Our status and our standing and our power in the tribe was cut out from under us. And I'm the weakest in my father's house, the least, excuse me, in my father's house, quite possibly the youngest. Possibly the only surviving of his brothers. And now it's, I think, that all these strange little things we see as Gideon ever so slowly, degree by degree, turns after the battle, starts to make sense. If during the battle he found out that Zebah and Zalmunna were the leaders involved, then it would be very easy for the battle to be the Lord's, but for Gideon to take it upon himself to pursue some family vengeance. That would explain why he pursues them. He didn't have to. They had already routed the Midianites. 120,000 got down. They weren't coming back. It would explain why he asked for reinforcements, because suddenly it was more important to him to get revenge on these kings in by whatever way he could. And now he's driving the agenda instead of God driving the agenda. God almost ceases to be mentioned in this story for the rest of the account. He's only mentioned a couple of times after the battle. It would explain why he called out Ephraim. It would explain why he went deep into enemy territory, risked his squad to the point where they had to seek help along the way. It would explain why he would be so upset with the people of Succoth and Penuel because they wouldn't help. And finally, when he asks the question that reveals that his brothers were killed sometime in the past, we begin to see what it is that just may be motivating Gideon to have turned like this. And if there's any doubt that there has been a gradual turning, at least gradual as it's laid out in the story, I don't know how gradual it was in Gideon's heart, it's kind of answered when he tells the men in verse 22 of chapter 8, they ask him to rule over them. And he says, I will not rule over you. We'll come back to that statement too. And my son will not rule over you. The Lord will rule over you. By the way, his son Jether didn't kill the kings. He didn't have the stomach for it. But, and that's another thing, by the way, that changes our view of Gideon. When I first meet Gideon in chapter 6, I think of him as a young man. But he's got a son who's old enough to have been in the army. That's at least 13. He had to have been bar mitzvahed. So Gideon isn't quite as young as I thought of him. Anyway, he says, I won't be your king. We'll come back to that statement in some detail. And Gideon says, let me make a request of you. He asks for the golden earrings that they would have taken off of these Ishmaelites, Midianites, peoples of the east, the opposing army, and some other spoils. And they gladly give it to him in verse 25. They spread the cloak, they toss it all out. It comes out to over 40 pounds of gold. And he uses it to fashion an ephod, a priestly garment piece out of gold. Now Aaron had one made at God's instruction. It was also gold. It was used by the high priest. Gideon has no reason to be doing this. And the text tells us flat out, verse 27, and Gideon made an ephod of it and put it in his city in Ophrah, and all Israel whored after it there, and it became a snare to Gideon and his family. So it becomes an object of worship and not the proper worship of Yahweh. And it's so tragic because the same man who destroyed the altar of Baal and cut down the Asherah tree and built an altar to Yahweh there in Ophrah has now come back and put up an object of idolatrous worship. That's just tragic. So Midian was subdued before the people of Israel, and they raised their heads no more, and the land had rest 40 years in the days of Gideon. But we're not done with the story of Gideon yet. That would normally be where the story ends, and we move on to a new cycle. And let me just say, this is the last time. We're only halfway through Judges. This is the last time that the text will tell us that Israel had peace. We've seen this slow decline. God always uses imperfect people, except once. But the imperfections in these judges are showing more and more and more as we go through the story. The depth of Israel's separation from Yahweh is increasing as we go through the story. We're going to see the worst we've seen yet very, very soon in the back half of this Gideon story. But this is the last time the cycle is complete as we've seen it up to now, saying that Israel had peace, the land had rest. It won't be said again in the book of Judges. Verse 29. Jerubbaal, which is Gideon, remember that's the name that he was given when he stood up, and his father stood up to his own townsmen after he destroyed that Baal altar. Jerubbaal means Baal fighter, basically. One who fights against Baal. Jerubbaal, the son of Joash, went and lived in his own house. Now, Gideon had 70 sons, his own offspring, for he had many wives. And his concubine, however many, many wives is, wasn't enough. And his concubine, who was in Shechem, also bore him a son. And he called his name Abimelech. And Gideon, the son of Joash, died in a good old age, and was buried in the tomb of Joash's father at Ophrah of the Abiezrites. There's a lot in that paragraph that needs to be observed. Gideon had told the people, "I will not be your king." And maybe officially he wasn't, but unofficially, he certainly lived like one. He collected, for all intents and purposes, a tax from the army with which he built this ephod. Making the ephod itself was an act that shouldn't be done by just anybody, shouldn't be done by Gideon, shouldn't be done by a king if he were one. It's a priestly issue. He had 70 sons and enough wives to have borne him 70 sons. That is not the harem of your everyday Israelite. That's not even like the harem of King David centuries later. It's more. And he had at least one concubine. Gideon was living the high life. There's no way around it. So if the people wanted him to be their king and he refused, de facto, he still lived as if he were a king. And most telling to me is what it says here about his son. The concubine who was in Shechem bore him a son in addition to his 70 sons. 70 legitimate sons. If this is the son of a concubine, he would not have been a legitimate son. And we'll see more about that later. And he called his name Abimelech. It's the way I've grown up hearing it pronounced. Abimelech is probably more accurate. You know, the affectionate name for God is Abba, father, dad. Abi, that suffix is a possessive. Abi means my father. And Melech means king. So he has named his son Abimelech, which means my father is king. No, I won't be your king, but I'll take your gold. I'll make a high priestly golden ephod. I'll establish a separate place of worship. I'll have a harem. And I'll name my son as if I were the king. There's a real disconnect there between what he said to the Israelites who asked him to be a king and what he really did. That little paragraph, verses 29, 30, 31, 32, says a lot about what had happened in Gideon's heart. And it's not good. He still receives credit in Hebrews 11 for his faith, and deservedly so. As there are conflicts that arise after his death, there are going to be people in this story who talk about the honor that should be given to Gideon and the honor that should be given to his family because of what he did against the Midianites, and that's accurate. But Gideon is not a perfect hero. He's the farthest from a perfect hero that we've seen yet. And this latter part of the story shows how hard it is to finish well. He listened to God. He obeyed God. He was used of God. God won a mighty battle for Israel through Gideon. But once Gideon found out that he could avenge something that had happened to his family in the past, he turned. And it's a very tragic story, and it's going to bear very tragic fruit. And that's what we need to get into now. But let me pause there and ask if there are any questions or thoughts that anyone would like to share. Okay. Let's see what happens once Gideon dies. It's not terribly surprising.
Eric, just one quick question.
Yeah, Dave.
Were sons of concubine considered legitimate?
Less so, and in Abimelech's case, significantly less so, for reasons that are about to come out. It's not just that he was the son of a concubine. It's who that concubine was that gives him definitely lesser standing in the family.
Because I find it interesting, given your definition of his name, that he would have been named that as the son of a concubine.
Yeah.
A joke to it.
Abimelech, in archaeology, in biblical archaeology, Abimelech shows up among the Philistines as a title in multiple generations, like Pharaoh in Egypt, like Yabin in the Canaanites. Abimelech shows up among the Philistines as a title, not as a personal name. My father is king, so indicating that I have the right to now rule. It is really curious that he named his illegitimate son that. And I'm not entirely sure what to make of it. Because it's not like he became known that or he called himself that. The text tells us flat out, Gideon called his name Abimelech.
So there's almost a joking quality about it.
Maybe.
Could it be he was far enough away that he wouldn't get in trouble for naming him that? I doubt that. If he was looking like a king, he probably had pretty good control. But don't you wonder?
Yeah, it's not something we can clearly answer. Verse 33. As soon as Gideon died, the people of Israel turned again and whored after the Baals and made Baal Berit their god. Berit means covenant. So Baal Berit, Baal of the covenant. It suggests that it's not just a coexistence with the Baal religion. I'm okay, you're okay. They're all okay. It suggests that there's more of a commitment to Baal that's involved now at this point. And by the way, let me say one other thing here. It's going to come into play in the story. Maybe there's a more appropriate place for me to say it, but I'm going to say it now because there's so many details I want to make sure I don't drop. When the story tells us that the Israelites wanted him to be their king, we immediately think of all of Israel, stem to stern, both sides of the Jordan, north to south. We think of Saul. We think of David. We think of the unified kingdom. That is not what Gideon was asked to be. We have already seen other times in the book of Judges where they talk about the people as the Israelites, but it's only a part of the nation. It's only down south where Othniel was dealing with the Philistines. It's only up north where Deborah and Barak were dealing with the Canaanites. It's limited places, and it's limited here. Gideon was not being asked to be king of all Israel. I mean, think about it. Jordan and Simeon to the south, they're not even in this story. Benjamin, not in this story. Ephraim is just outside the story until they pursue the enemy on Gideon's behalf. There's a lot of Israel that's not part of the story. Gideon was being asked to be a king, yes. And it shows us that the impulse among the people to desire a king has early roots. But it's not king over all the 12 tribes. It's only king over a region, over an area. That's important as we see what happens with Abimelech. Verse 34, and the people of Israel did not remember the Lord their God, who had delivered them from the hand of all their enemies on every side, and they did not show steadfast love to the family of Jerubbaal, that is Gideon, in return for all the good that he had done to Israel. How soon they forget, in other words. And chapter 9. Now Abimelech, the son of Jerubbaal, went to Shechem to his mother's relatives and said to them and to the whole clan of his mother's family, say in the ears of all the leaders of Shechem, which is better for you, that all 70 of the sons of Jerubbaal rule over you, or that one rule over you? Remember also that I am your bone and your flesh. And his mother's relatives spoke all these words on his behalf in the ears of all the leaders of Shechem, and their hearts inclined to follow Abimelech, for they said, he is our brother. And they gave him 70 pieces of silver out of the house of Baal Berit, with which Abimelech hired worthless and reckless fellows who followed him. We'll stop there for a moment. Abimelech goes down to Shechem. This is several miles south of Ophrah. Ophrah is in the northeastern corner. No maps today, sorry, but you can handle this. Ophrah is in the northeastern corner of Manasseh. Shechem is on the southern edge of Manasseh. And when Abimelech sets up his seat of power, it's actually going to be across the border in northern Ephraim. So we're talking about a territory here that isn't very big. Gideon gets called Jerubbaal more and more as the story goes on. And there's some play on words going on here. Abimelech has gone to Shechem. And when he tells his family, speak on my behalf to the leaders of Shechem, some Bibles translate it, the captains of Shechem, the men of Shechem, that word that is being translated as men or captain or leaders, that word in Hebrew is Baal. It is the very same as the name of the false Canaanite god. Now, Hebrew does something very similar with the word Adonai. Adonai is a name for God himself. Adonai is the name for a king or a city ruler. Remember Adonai Bezek, that cut his thumbs and big toes off? King of Bezek, Lord of Bezek. Adonai also can just mean sir. So there's a range of meanings, and that's true of Baal. But Hebrew here has just imported the word in. Why would Abimelech ask his family to speak to the Baal of Shechem? Because if he used that word to refer to a Hebrew community, he would never have persuaded anyone. It is not stated in the story, but it is implicit and inescapable because he uses this word, and it's only used for the leaders in Shechem. The leaders in Shechem are Canaanites. Israelites have been coexisting in Shechem with the Canaanites. Who founded Shechem? It's going to come out in the story in a moment. His name was Hamor. He was a Canaanite, specifically a Hivite.
My Bible doesn't refer to him as refers to him as citizens of Shechem.
Yeah, but the word is Baal. It is. The language makes it inescapable that there is a strong Canaanite influence in the leadership at Shechem. And if he's talking this way to his own family on his mother's side, then the next inescapable conclusion is that Abimelech's mother was a Canaanite, probably a Hivite, but she was not Hebrew. And that is why he has an even more clearly lower standing within his family than any of the 70 sons of Gideon, who were born by Gideon's many wives. Not that many wives is a great idea, but they were all Hebrew wives. They were all marriages done under the wedding canopy, the chuppah. They were all weddings that would have had a ketubah, a marriage document. But not Abimelech's mother. She would have been a Canaanite mistress that Gideon kept down at Shechem. And Abimelech may have been able to come up and live in his father's household, but he never would have had the standing of any of the others. All things that come out when you realize the language that's being used in the text. And very helpful to understand some of the motivations involved. Abimelech knows he is never going to be anything in Gideon's house. But maybe he can be something on, through his mother's side of the family. So he goes to Shechem and he makes his pitch. And they go for it. I'm not sure how realistic it was, his argument. Would 70 sons of Gideon really have ruled over them, or would it only have been the oldest, right? Or would it have been any at all? Well, if Gideon lived like a king, I can see where people would expect it. But Israel seems to have been expecting that Gideon's offspring, and whether it's 1 or 70, would lead and rule, at least this part of Israel. And if somebody who is, you know, their brother, their bone, their flesh, were to be the ruler, then Shechem gets really good standing. So that's the piece of this that appeals to them. We get one of our own to be the ruler. We have an inside. So they talk to the Baal, the leaders of Shechem, and their hearts are inclined to follow Abimelech, and they give him 70 pieces of silver out of the Baal temple. Maybe not a coincidence, 70 pieces of silver, 70 sons of Gideon, because Abimelech takes that money and he hires his dirty, rotten scoundrels. And at verse 5, and he went to his father's house at Ophrah and killed his brothers, the sons of Jerubbaal, 70 men on one stone. But actually not 70, unless we're talking round numbers, because Jotham, the youngest son of Jerubbaal, was left, for he hid himself. So one son of Gideon got away. Sounds like a good movie plot. And all the leaders of Shechem came together, and all Beth Millo, and they went and made Abimelech king by the oak of the pillar at Shechem. Anybody remember that spot? The oak by the pillar at Shechem. We were there about 200 years before this. Israel had crossed the Jordan. Joshua had called them together. Half of them on the Mount Gerizim side of the valley, half of them on the Mount Ebal side of the valley, and Shechem is in the middle. And this natural amphitheater, and Joshua read all the law to them and said, "Will you follow it?" And they said, "Yes, we will." "Will you follow Yahweh?" They said, "Yes, we will." He said, "Make sure you understand what you're saying, because you're not going to be able to do it." And they said, "Yes, we will." And he said, "Okay, will you be witnesses against yourselves that you have committed to follow Yahweh?" And they said, "Yes, we will." So Joshua wrote all the words of this law on the pillar and erected it at Shechem next to an oak tree. And now we're back at that very same spot. And nothing that's going on has anything to do with faithfulness to Yahweh. In the very place where Joshua raised the stone of witness to be against them if they turned away from Yahweh, they have turned away from Yahweh in spades. And they are making Abimelech their king. And they are now run by Canaanites. It's a really, really, really sad moment when you stop and realize where this is and what the history of that spot is. But they make Abimelech king over at least some section of eastern Manasseh. When this was told, I'm back in the text at verse 7, when this was told to Jotham, he went and stood on top of Mount Gerizim and cried aloud and said to them, "Listen to me, you leaders of Shechem, that God may listen to you." He's reenacting in a different way what Joshua did 200 years earlier. There was this antiphonal thing going on between the half of the tribes that were on Mount Gerizim and the half that were on the slopes of Mount Ebal, back and forth. and the valley carries the sound well, and Jotham is on the slopes of Gerizim, and he is shouting down to Shechem, and they can hear him. And he tells them a parable. Not a very hard parable to understand. A parable that becomes a prophecy that will shape what God is going to do in this story. It's almost as if God gave Jotham the words, right? Yes, right. Listen to me, you leaders of Shechem, that God may listen to you. The trees once went out to anoint a king over them. And they said to the olive tree, "Reign over us." But the olive tree said to them, "Shall I leave my abundance by which gods and men are honored and go hold sway over the trees?" And the tree said to the fig tree, "You come and reign over us." But the fig tree said to them, "Shall I leave my sweetness and my good fruit and go hold sway over the trees?" And the tree said to the vine, "You come and reign over us." But the vine said to them, "Shall I leave my wine that cheers God and men and go hold sway over the trees?" Then all the trees said to the bramble, okay, now let me just stop there a minute. How many different trees have they gone to ask them to be king? One. The olive tree is the only true tree in this list, and it's been going down from there. The fig is much more of a bush. The vine isn't anything remotely like a tree, unless you train it. And the bramble grows along the ground. So it's a very quick descent through the forms of plant life that the trees in this parable are asking to rule over them. And every one of them is saying, I have a purpose. Why would I want to stop fulfilling that purpose just to sway over a bunch of trees? So they get to the bramble. Then all the trees said to the bramble, the thorn bush, in other words, "You come and reign over us." And the bramble said to the trees, "If in good faith you are anointing me king over you, then come and take refuge in my shade." A bramble has no shade. "But if not, let fire come out from the bramble and devour the cedars of Lebanon." And that's not just a picture out of the blue. One of the problems with brambles, and one of the reasons that they were cleared away from arable land whenever possible, is that they spread fire fast. If the brambles caught on fire, it would be a lot harder to contain the burn. So fire coming out from the bramble is a real thing that would be understood by people hearing Jotham's little parable here. "Now, therefore, if you acted in good faith," this is now Jotham, he stepped away from the tree parable. "Now, therefore, if you acted in good faith and integrity when you made Abimelech king, and if you have dealt well with Jerubbaal and his house, and have done to him as his deeds deserved, for my father fought for you and risked his life and delivered you from the hand of Midian, and you have risen up against my father's house this day and have killed his sons, 70 men on one stone, and have made Abimelech, the son of his female slave, king over the leaders of Shechem, because he is your relative." Jotham knows absolutely what's going on here. "If you then have acted in good faith and integrity with Jerubbaal and with his house this day, then rejoice in Abimelech, and let him also rejoice in you. But if not, let fire come out from Abimelech and devour the leaders of Shechem and Beth Millo. And let fire come out from the leaders of Shechem and from Beth Millo and devour Abimelech." And Jotham ran away and fled and went to Be'er and lived there because of Abimelech, his brother. Now, we don't know where Be'er is. It's not that we've never been able to find it archaeologically. It's that we have found it everywhere. Because Be'er simply means the well, like a water well. So you've got Beersheba, Beersheba. You've got all sorts of Be'ers all over the place. We don't know which one he went to. It doesn't matter. Jotham fled. He knew he didn't stand a chance if he stuck around. But he spoke the truth. He challenged them to consider what they had done. And then the story fast forwards a little bit. Verse 22. Abimelech ruled over Israel for 3 years. Actually, the word there isn't the same word that's normally used for rule or reign. It's the word for command. So there's a little question as to whether the writer is really giving Abimelech credit as a legitimate king. But we don't have to make too much of that.
Could this go back to what you said? It's just a small section of Israel, not...
Yes, and it could definitely could, and it also could involve the way in which he was made king. And the two could both be in play there. And God sent an evil spirit between Abimelech and the leaders of Shechem. And the leaders of Shechem dealt treacherously with Abimelech. That the violence done to the 70 sons of Jerubbaal might come, and their blood be laid on Abimelech their brother, who killed them, and on the men of Shechem, who strengthened his hands to kill his brothers. So the writer here, and I've said before, I think it was Samuel, here is saying that this evil spirit sent by God is specifically being sent to bring justice, to cause things to happen that will unfold in a way that will justly deal with what has happened. There's a lesson there too. There aren't any good guys left. Abimelech isn't a good guy. The leaders of Shechem aren't good guys. There's another character coming into the story soon named Gaal. He is not a good guy. But none of that thwarts God's purpose. God can use people who do not follow him to accomplish what God wants to accomplish. And that is something to especially keep in mind today, because it is harder and harder to find godly people among the leadership of pick a country. That doesn't mean God can't accomplish his purposes. He can. And he does, and he will. So the leaders of Shechem, who helped Abimelech come to power, suddenly now there's some conflict between them. Just 3 years in to his reign. That's a pretty short time compared to other things we've seen in the book of Judges. Also interesting that the oppression that now this part of the story deals with is not oppression from the Midianites, or the Canaanites, or the Philistines, or the Amalekites. It's oppression from within. Because Abimelech is not a nice king. So, what do the leaders of Shechem do? Verse 25. And the leaders of Shechem put men in ambush against him on the mountaintops, that they robbed, and they robbed all who passed by them along that way, and it was told to Abimelech. Understand what's happening here. The leaders of Shechem have hired bandits to hide out in the hills, and this is hilly country. Shechem is in a strategic location in its area. It's on the main north-south road, and it's on an east-west road that leads down into the Jordan Valley. So Shechem sees traffic. And what does that mean you get to do if you're the ruler in Shechem? It means you get to collect taxes or tolls or tariffs from these people who are trying to move their goods through the area. And they need to move their goods through the area. It's a strategic location. So Abimelech is in a position to be making some good money. And the leaders of Shechem know it. So in order to disrupt him, they put bandits in the hills to attack these caravans. And if they rob the caravans, then the caravans can't pay Abimelech. And it disrupts his income stream. That's why they're doing it. And it was told to Abimelech. And I want to stop there, because the new character, Gaal, is about to walk in on stage, and I'd rather not get into that when it's 10:18. So we'll pause the story right there, and we will finish this fascinating tale next week. It is starting to look like a soap opera. You're right. In a way, Judges has been looking like a soap opera for a while. And in some respects, it might even be tempting to say that they've jumped the shark now, if you know that phrase. If you don't, ask me after class. But it's still, this is what really happened. There are more subtleties to come, more interesting coincidences and nuances to come. And justice is coming, and it'll be interesting to see how God makes that work. Final thoughts or questions? Elmer gets the last word. Okay. Let's close in prayer. Heavenly Father, thank you that you bring about your will regardless of who is there to help you. With someone like Gideon who needed confidence, you gave confidence. With someone like Othniel, who was faithful from the start, you used him. But here in a situation where there was no one who follows you, you still brought about your will. Help us to remember that when we lose hope in a world that is increasingly secular, that is increasingly hostile to you and to your people. We pray in Jesus' name. Amen.